people who, and if you don't have a writing utensil, I think you're gonna wanna.
Do I want a writing utensil?
Oh, we need to write?
Yeah.
All right, are you gonna be sitting up in the balcony?
In the balcony, I gotta leave early, so.
Great, well, we'll do a better job of incorporating the nobles today. I noticed yesterday that poor nobles didn't read anything. It was all the groundlings.
Groundlings.
It was all the 99% got to go all reading.
Except we got chairs.
Yeah, it's true. It's really a cushy kind of groundling situation you folks have.
Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you too.
What are you talking about, noble? This isn't noble.
He's in Reality Bites and he did
Hamlet
and they did it in a, so he's doing the soliloquy in a blockbuster, you know. He's holding up, do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's holding up like a VHS.
It
was
where they did all of Shakespeare's plays.
Ethan Hawke.
Yeah.
Well, what an ass am I?
I've got some good lines.
Yeah, that would be something.
Did you like? Well, I didn't know English. Did you like it?
I
like it.
You don't know those things. Did you like it?
Yeah, like having a while you're on the jury.
Yeah, right. It's like.
I thought it was well done. It's always nice.
All right. We have a quorum of groundlings and at least one person representing 1%. So that's good. So Hamlet, his father has been killed, and you'll want a pencil too. His father's been killed. He returns from college and finds out that his mother's remarried in less than 2 months to his uncle. And what we haven't seen him yet in the play. This is going to be the first appearance of him. And all we know is that he's been walking around in all black, and by all accounts, he's a real Debbie Downer. And his mother says, "Thou know'st, 'tis common. All that lives must die, passing through nature into eternity." "Aye, madam, it is common. If it be, why seems it so particular in thee?" "Seems, madam. Nay, it is. I know not. Seems. 'Tis not alone my inky cloak, good mother, nor customary suits of solemn black, nor windy suspiration of forced breath, no, nor the fruitful river in the eye, nor the dejected behavior of the visage, together with all forms, shapes, moods of grief that can denote me truly. These indeed seem, for they are actions that a man might play. But I have that within which passeth show. These but the trappings and the suits of woe." So the first significant amount of text we have from Hamlet has to do with the impenetrability of his character. And I think any actor that says gets cast in this role and hasn't watched all of the movies gets to about that point and goes, "What was I thinking? What was I thinking? He's impossible to play. He can't." All the things I know that are supposed to make me look sad, the fruitful river in the eye, the dejected behavior of the visage, you know, the windy suspiration of forced breath, you know, all of these things that would indicate how I'm supposed to be feeling. Apparently Hamlet is beyond these. Apparently he has it all within. Apparently there's something going on here that you can't necessarily see by all the external clues we usually rely on. So we're looking at Hamlet today, and it's really exciting to have you folks here to tackle this this character. How many people have seen Hamlet in some form or another? Have you read it? Or great. So Chris is new to Hamlet, which is, I think, the best way to meet Hamlet. It's famously the really daunting and much coveted role for every actor to sort of. And at some point, you have to just ignore Laurence Olivier and ignore Richard Burton and ignore Kenneth Branagh, anybody who's committed it to celluloid and thus, you know, informed every characterization thereafter. And you have to sort of spread eagle yourself into the giant silhouette of Hamlet. And I think that's what ends up often happening is you have people coming on stage and going, to be or not to be, that is the question. I hope to know in the mind to suffer the sling and arrows, my greatest fortune. As though like everybody already knows the words and you can't do anything new. So everybody's so eager to do something new. How can I put my stamp on Hamlet? How can I have my Hamlet? Mostly because I want to be, you know, discovered and then move on from there. So what I'd like to present is, since Hamlet is so uniquely, you know, formed in thought. I mean, he's a character that spends the whole play thinking out loud for us. And it's a wonderful challenge. It's incredibly elusive to bring that to vivid life. How can we make those arguments not only, you know, interesting but actually riveting? How can we get people to actually care? And I think it has to do with it's actually a sort of simple. It's simpler than an actor might think, who's trying to play the most famous character in the world. And if you can forget that his name is Hamlet for a little while and just say, okay, he's got all these thoughts. How can I internalize and then externalize these thoughts? How can I own this? How can I embody? How can I dramatize thought? And so I'm going to present two sort of, I wouldn't say contradict, two complementary approaches that actors might take to taking ownership of language that is particularly thoughtful, or you might even say heady. But the first one is a paraphrasing model, and we'll do that. We'll apply that to the first speech, and the second one is what I like to call, I don't know a name for this, but we'll call it the distilling model. And what we're going to do is we're going to in the paraphrasing model, what I mean by paraphrase, to be clear, is that it's not coming up with an easy. You have to describe everything. We're going to take for granted that this is everything that needs to be communicated. It's just how Shakespeare put it, and we need to find a way to put it in our own words in order to fully appreciate what Shakespeare's saying. Because this is a funky vernacular, and the cadence or the kind of syntax is odd. So we're going to take every bit of meaning that we get out of this and paraphrase it, and then figure out what that says, and then hopefully return, and then eventually return, and hopefully have our interpretations lift up Shakespeare's original. And the second, what we're going to do, is we're going to distill each kind of major thoughts, the major movements of the speech into its simplest thesis, and then from there we will slowly reincorporate language, parentheticals, things that are not utterly essential, but hopefully we'll discover something of how important they are, or we'll decide that maybe that's not important, and maybe we don't need to be precious about that, and it can be cut. But so we're gonna today. Yesterday we did some speeches, and I think it was difficult. We found to just pass them around initially without having a shape of what the speech was. And so today, I think we're gonna try a Lectio Shakespearea, where I'll sort of on this first speech. I'll share it with you. Hey, Jeremy, welcome. I'm going to give you one of these.
Thanks for writing.
We're going to take this first one, and I'm going to go from thought to thought. And what you'll find is that all the punctuation in this, all the end full stops, exclamation points, question marks, or periods, actually indicate the end of a thought, which is not, editors do a really good job of messing that up sometimes. But other than the question mark at the end of "and let all sleep," which is 2, 4, 6, 8 lines from the bottom, you can ignore that question mark. That's a mistake. But every other full stop is the end of a thought. So the first way I'm going to present this is from thought to thought. And the next way, and we won't talk until after the, or we won't share it until after the second one, but the second way I'm going to approach it is from line to line, observing the verse. And I just want to get a feel for how that comes across your ear differently. And so I think we'll talk after the second. So where are we? This speech is often cut. It's a great speech. It's most often cut because it once you hear it, you'll realize, and I share this context with you, Hamlet's just done the play within the play. He's convinced himself his uncle is guilty. His father's word is good. Okay, now I can kill this man. He's about to kill him, but he's praying. And so he decides he can't kill him while he's praying because then he'll go to heaven. What kind of vengeance is that if I send my father's killer to heaven? Which is troublesome on a lot of levels, but we won't go into that yet. But this is his uncle has banished him to England with secret designs to have him killed there. Hamlet doesn't know that yet, but he's going to figure it out. But at this point, he gets his kind of jailers to leave him alone, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who are actually his friends, but they're carrying him to a boat to take him away to England. And he's left alone on stage, and he says, "How all occasions do inform against me and spur my dull revenge. What is a man if his chief good and market of his time be but to sleep and feed? A beast, no more. Sure he that made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability and godlike reason to fust in us unused. Now, whether it be bestial oblivion or some craven scruple of thinking too precisely on the event, a thought which, quartered, hath but one part wisdom and ever three parts coward, I do not know why yet I live to say this thing's to do, sith I have cause and will and strength and means to do it. Examples gross as earth exhort me. Witness this army of such mass and charge, led by a delicate and tender prince, whose spirit with divine ambition puffed makes mouths at the invisible event, exposing what is mortal and unsure to all that fortune, death, and danger dare, even for an eggshell, rightly to be great, is not to stir without great argument, but greatly to find quarrel in a straw when honor's at the stake. How stand I then, that have a father killed, a mother stained, excitements of my reason and my blood, and let all sleep, while to my shame I see the imminent death of 20,000 men that for a fantasy and trick of fame go to their graves like beds, fight for a plot whereon the numbers cannot try the cause, which is not tomb enough and continent to hide the slain. Oh, from this time forth, my thoughts be bloody or be nothing worth." Now we'll do line to line. "How all occasions do inform against me and spur my dull revenge. What is a man if his chief good and market of his time be but to sleep and feed? A beast no more? Sure he that made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability and godlike reason to fust in us unused. Now, whether it be bestial oblivion or some craven scruple of thinking too precisely on the event, a thought which, quartered, hath but one part wisdom and ever three parts coward, I do not know why yet I live to say this thing's to do, sith I have cause and will and strength and means to do it. Examples gross as earth exhort me. Witness this army of such mass and charge, led by a delicate and a tender prince, whose spirit with divine ambition puffed makes mouths at the invisible event, exposing what is mortal and unsure to all that fortune, death, and danger dare, even for an eggshell, rightly to be great, is not to stir without great argument, but greatly to find quarrel in a straw when honor's at the stake. How stand I then, that have a father killed, a mother stained, excitements of my reason and my blood, and let all sleep, whilst to my shame I see the imminent death of 20,000 men, that for a fantasy and trick of fame go to their graves like beds, fight for a plot whereon the numbers cannot try the cause, which is not tomb enough and continent to hide the slain. Oh, from this time forth, my thoughts be bloody or be nothing worth. So how did, are there any, I mean, do you get a sense of what he's thinking? Or were you totally lost? Or were you, could you follow?
Was there a real battle that was going to be coming up, or was this a metaphor?
I should have mentioned. Just in brief passing, Fortinbras, the prince, also Hamlet's a prince, and Fortinbras is the prince of Norway. And a commander has just walked by and asked Hamlet, and Hamlet has said, "What?" He sees thousands of men, and he's learned that they're all coming to occupy essentially this, like, you know, orchard. It's, you know, it's all, it's, what is that called? I don't know my war terminology well enough, but, you know, it's like posturing. They're sort of arriving and, you know, nobody's going to actually even stand up. You know, nobody's going to resist them. They're just going to kind of march 20,000 men into this spot and take it over. They don't know, you know, the men don't know that, but, you know, this is a officer who's in the know. So that he's juxtaposing this, you know.
This, yeah. But people will die.
Yeah.
He's just saying for this something so unimportant, really.
Yeah.
The whim of a prince.
Yeah, the whim of a prince who needs to establish himself in Scandinavia, or, you know, or needs to, you know, or the Baltic, you know, the region. But did that, was it clearer in your mind one way or the other to hear it move from thought to thought, or to have it land on those, to have each meter sort of?
I thought it was clear both ways, but they were just totally different characters.
Mm-hmm.
The second one was much more uncertain, more thoughtful, really kind of searching for his words and that sort of thing. The first one, much more confident and more sure of himself in some ways, was my interpretation of the two performances.
That's great. And we must, you know, the second one took a lot longer. He takes longer to, and I think, you know, there is a way to, I was, you know, in some ways overemphasizing this observance of the verse. I think you can do it. And there's certainly a happy medium. I think, you know, you would finesse that in a performance to sort of find out where it's most useful to not know and what things you can really move through because you knew them before you started saying them.
I thought it was much clearer when you did it the first time and paused at the end of each thought.
Mm-hmm. And were you familiar with the speech before I shared it?
No.
Hmm. Great. So that's really helpful to know that on a first listen, that was clearer.
I was just fascinated by the fact that you brought the second reading to life, because I just thought it would just be line to line, and yet there was so much inflection and pause within the line. The fact it gave some new life to each of those lines, even though it didn't flow.
Right, didn't have a. And you know that's something that in rehearsal you kind of you would certainly,
right.
Well, you wouldn't iron it out, but you would sew it together. Yeah, Jeremy.
I came in late. I apologize. Mm. Maybe you said this, but is there a preferred way to prefer that this is generally performed?
No,
Shakespeare's generally performed.
I would say that, I mean, in my experience, between these two schools of thought, it was when I studied in London, teachers, I had a teacher who just swore by this line-to-line reading, and I have to confess, we thought it was crazy.
Really?
We thought it was insane.
Yeah.
And most of the most remarkable work I saw from my classmates, 19 people, or 18 other people with whom I spent 4 years in movement pants and pretending we were bacon and doing Shakespeare, and you know, most of the finest work I saw them do was when they could when they only had enough breath to give you one line at a time.
Sure.
And there is and in terms of naturalism, there's a whole argument there because really, we break up our thoughts all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Actually,
just did,
right?
Mm-hmm.
In life, you know, and but it's funny how we it's you know, it's a bit like. Yeah, that's something that I don't think that's a viable argument that it would break up the thought too much. I'd say it's a lot more challenging to do it line to line. I think the natural inclination is to just follow through the thought.
Sure.
But sometimes there's a belief that this 10 beat line, this verse line, is our heartbeat. You know, that's ba bum ba bum ba bum ba bum. It's so instinctive,
mm-hmm.
And we actually 70% of the time. That we talk, we speak in iambic pentameter.
Mm-hmm.
With people have done studies of this, and recorded speech. And it's just that's our natural default.
Well, I was surprised that I could even understand both methods by which you spoke this, because we have attended, I believe, Hamlet, you know, at least once, and probably other times after Guthrie. Probably the old and the new,
right.
If you have. And we simply could not. I couldn't follow the thought at all. I couldn't follow the really what was said at all. Part of it is the acoustics are good for your voice in this room.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Better.
Yeah.
Better than the new Guthrie anyway.
Yeah.
I have a content question.
Yeah.
Even for an eggshell, does that mean just even for a trifle? Or
Yeah. So I would love to move on to this, to involving you folks in this. I shared how each punctuation mark is a thought. And if people want to get in groups of three, what I want to do is pass around all eight, essentially. I'm not including a beast no more as a thought, because I don't know how much we can really paraphrase that any better than a beast no more. You can, if everybody gets in groups of three, maybe this group would be, Do you folks want to start with number one, which will go from How All Occasions to Dull Revenge? And it might not take you very long. Feel free to move on to another one if you get bored of, and so that again, the idea of paraphrasing is that you have to express everything that's expressed by Shakespeare, but in your own words. So it doesn't have to be one line. I mean, however many lines it takes you to say what Shakespeare said. So who's doing? Is anybody doing two? Does anybody want to do two? It's a shorter one. Great, two there, and three goes from Sure He That Made. To fustinus unused. Does anybody want to do three?
What does F-U-S-T mean?
Oh, it was an invented word. It hadn't been in the lexicon before, so Shakespeare presented it to the world there. What is that? What does compost do?
Decompose.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks. Yeah. Sounds like fust. Down to eggshell.
Yeah.
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 Did you want to
have a good? Oh, we could go over
the only
would you like to
only seven?
supposed to.
Yeah, the reasonable is, yes.
And if anybody asks any questions, feel free to
have another group.
Oh, great.
Would it be like
anyone? I don't think anybody's done.
Like I'm just daydreaming.
8 or 6, whichever one you want. I mean,
what's that?
We can't use like
that's the one I'm at.
Look at this guy with all from this time.
Yeah, they're ready to die with nothing. Meanwhile,
to be great.
Over processing. Yeah.
So like be still a little
scared. Yeah. 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 Was killed. I think that's the whole thing.
Yes, I know. I'm just telling you.
But it's looking at the army to fight for
that is such harsh discourse.
This is the action.
So the delicate I think is the ability
to
perceive confidence.
Yes, please do.
I become.
All right, well, I'm going to, is everybody have something they would be willing to share? All right. Sounds like we're getting ready. I think then the thing to do is everybody comfortable? Anybody who doesn't want to speak out loud, speak the speech in any way, is not at all required to, so don't feel pressured to speak. But I'd like to first have people speak through this, the text, as is. And then I want everybody to speak their paraphrases, and then we'll speak it again. And I think what we're going to do is thought to thought, because it seemed to be that was what made sense, and that's also how you paraphrase. So if we want to begin here with
they were
Shakespeare's Lane. Oh, that's right.
One was upstairs.
Would you mind starting with your as Shakespeare wrote it this time? And
so are we going group to group with our reading, like?
Yeah, actually, that would be.
So one person
first Shakespeare,
group,
then.
Read the thought.
So actually, does everybody? So who had one? Who had two? Who had three? Who had four? Who had five? Who had six? Sonia, did you have six?
Well, yes.
We did, perfect. Did anybody have seven? All right. And did anybody have eight? Okay, well, I'll do eight then, so that we can finish it off. So has every group have a designated person to pick up the energy of the last?
Yeah.
The last.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. So as long as everybody knows who's going to, and then someone else will speak the paraphrase next time, but I'll be with you straight, go a little before.
How all occasions do inform against me and spur my dull revenge.
Oh, I'm sorry, we're just doing, sorry.
Oh, we can start again, yeah. We're just doing Shakespeare this time.
Can we start again?
Yeah, we'll start again. I'll be with you straight, go a little before.
How all occasions do inform against me and spur my dull revenge.
What is a man if his chief good and market of his time be but to sleep and feed?
A beast, no more.
Sure, he that made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability and godlike reason to fust in us unused.
Now, whether it be bestial oblivion or some craven scruple of thinking too precisely on the event, a thought which quartered hath but one part wisdom and ever three parts coward. I do not know why yet I live to say this thing's to do, since I have cause and will and strength and means to do it.
Examples gross as earth exhort me. Witness this army of such mass and charge, led by a delicate and tender prince, whose spirit with divine ambition puffed, makes mouths at the invisible event, exposing what is mortal and unsure to all that fortune, death, and danger dare, even for an eggshell.
Rightly, to be great is not to stir without great argument, but greatly to find quarrel in a straw when honor's at the stake.
How stand I then that have a father killed, a mother stained? Excitements of my reason and my blood, and let all sleep, while to my shame I see the imminent death of 20,000 men, that, for a fantasy and trick of fame, go to their graves like beds, fight for a plot whereon the numbers cannot try the cause, which is not tomb enough and continent to hide the slain.
Oh, from this time forth, my thoughts be bloody, or be nothing worth. Cool. Now, without speaking about it, I'd love to just go right into the paraphrases. So if a different person, whoever in the group wants to read the paraphrase, and what, you know, it's all fine, no matter how long it ended up being. And if you need to kind of improvise it on the spot, if you didn't write it down, that's great too, but just to cover the full sense of what Shakespeare said. So I'll be with you in a second. Go ahead of me a little while.
Oh, everything is working against me. And angering me as well.
What's it all about for us? If our ultimate concern and use of time is just to hibernate and be a consumer, I become my iPod, nothing more. dude, the creator dude who made us, gave us a brain to use, not to throw in the compost pile.
Whether you're just as dumb as an animal, or as unthinking as an animal, or have just imagined the murder too clearly, and this is resulting in some kind of cowardly moral qualms that is mostly cowardice and only a pinch of wisdom. So why... You know, since I have all the reason to do it, and I have the means, motive, and opportunity, why haven't I done this thing yet?
Okay, I got a huge example before me. This prince has got this huge army, and he's pumped up with all kinds of ambition, and he's trash talking over whatever. Exposing these people to possible death and danger for a freaking egg show.
The noble won't go to battle without much deliberation, but I'll duke it out over nothing to save face.
Shouldn't I seek revenge now that my father is killed and my mother stained? And then I lose it there because to me I would put a question mark and a period and that's one thought.
Right.
And I would start out and then...
Well, great. No, I think that's... And then, I think that is a fair break of the thought. So we would say maybe all these... everything that's agitating my my thought and my... I mean, I guess why I did keep that as a thought is that I think of the excitements of my reason and my blood, things that are agitating both my thinking and, you know, this is my family we're talking about here. And yet I still hibernate, I believe is the lingo we're using. And then I do this while... You know, I can see so many more people than me who, for nothing, for a chance to get in the New York, the cover of Time magazine, are gonna die as easily as they would go to sleep. They're going to fight for something that, you know, the amount of people involved have no relation to they're involved in. And there's not actually enough space that we're deliberating over to bury the amount of people who could be harmed by it.
Right.
And then, so, in conclusion, from now on, it's vengeance time. So I think that was terrific. I lift. I think we have a lift act. It was, and it was really funny how I think people kind of adopted our vernacular, or you know, that I think that was really great. That and funny that it was still eggshell. That the best thing we could come up with to describe a tiny, ridiculous, inconsequential thing. That is there anything really better than an eggshell? Isn't that maybe the perfect image for?
Can't even put that in the compost pile. So.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Isn't it good for that?
And funny that, you know, I wasn't thinking about this, but, you know, fussed in us unused. I mean, what a set of sounds. What a kind of tongue twister for the mouth. Does anybody have any thoughts on the richness of whether you felt, did you feel like you said everything that Shakespeare said in your paraphrase? I felt like
I just like to do this with this whole play and then go see.
Yeah, what would it look like? People do that.
We could be the groundlings yelling, compost pile!
You could have a compost pile.
I think what I was impressed with is that in all this beautiful writing, these are the kinds of things you go that go round and round in your head.
Yeah.
He puts them down. I mean, these are all the things that are why we delay, you know, what we're thinking.
It doesn't matter if it's whether you're going to kill your uncle or not.
No, I hardly ever object
to it.
I hardly ever think about killing my uncle.
But
when it comes to what's for dinner, when it comes to colleges, when it comes to, you know, horseback riding instructors, I think these things...
And we come to the point where, why do I keep screwing around with this in my head? Why don't I just do it? You know, why don't I just take a leap? And so I think that this is us.
Read to the end of the play and you'll find out.
Well, yeah. All right, I know that,
He dies in the end.
No, he dies in the end.
It's Shakespeare.
That.
No,
only the Marshall Pollock survives.
Yeah.
Right.
But it is a great way to study the play. Yeah.
So it is useful.
It is.
You find that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, because I found myself much more engaged than, you know, in English class. Sorry. When I just read it. And I kept trying to make it. Just an English teacher. You know, and Sandy didn't teach that way. Where I just tried to make it, you know, very ordinary language and be serious about it, it was much less engaging. So being able to have some fun with it.
Mm-hmm. Be irreverent with it a little.
Then you could go back and say, well, this is really beautifully well done. And they are thoughts that we all have and get stuck in the movie with.
I think we were all really entertained, and not just entertained, we were really engaged by what everybody said. I would argue, though, that there were some things that weren't totally captured. In the paraphrase, there's some things that were lost in translation, but this is why people are always adapting this play. People are always making arguments for why we should actually only perform these plays this way. Mm-hmm. That this is the only way that they're still relevant because people immediately receive them. But I'd like to, that being said, return to the third person in each group, the only person in the first group, going through. I want to see if it informs our reading this time. If our paraphrase, if our words, our version of Shakespeare's words can lift Shakespeare's words in a way that's richer, if we can hear it differently, or, you know, maybe not richer or better, but differently. What stands out this time, if anything different? So does everybody know who the third person to read is now? Or it can be a repeat reader, too, if somebody doesn't want to read.
We're just doing Shakespeare again.
We're just Shakespeare.
Yes.
Just fusty Shakespeare. So is everybody ready to...
Everybody ready to roll?
I'll be with you straight. Go a little before.
How all occasions do inform against me and spur my dull revenge.
What is a man? If his chief good and market of his time be but to sleep and feed, a beast no more.
Sure he that made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability in godlike reason to fust in us unused.
No, whether it be bestial oblivion or some craven scruple of thinking too precisely on the event, a thought which quartered hath but one part wisdom and ever three parts coward, I do not know why I yet live to say the things to do, since I have cause and will and strength and means to do it.
Examples gross as earth exhort me. Witness this army of such mass and charge, led by a delicate and tender prince whose spirit with divine ambition puffed makes mouths at the invisible event. Exposing what is mortal and unsure to all that fortune, death, and danger dare, even for an eggshell.
Rightly to be great is not to stir without great argument, but greatly to find quarrel in a straw when honor's at the stake.
I'm lost. Thank you.
Oh, sorry.
How
stand I then that have a father killed, a mother stained, excitements of my reason and my blood, and let all sleep, while to my shame I see the imminent death of 20,000 men, that, for a fantasy and trick of fame, go to their graves like beds, fight for a plot whereon the numbers cannot try the cause, which is not tomb enough and continent to hide the slain.
Oh, from this time forth, my thoughts be bloody or be nothing worth. How did that feel, speaking it and hearing it?
Even picked up more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can see it again for the first time. Yeah.
There's something I love about the speech is, trippingly on the tongue, Hamlet says, speak the speech, I pray you, as I pronounced it to you, trippingly on the tongue, lightly and quickly is the implication of trippingly, not tripping on your, over yourself. But one thing that always slows us down is monosyllables. And this speech has the longest stretch of monosyllables in the entire canon. 26 one-stress words in a row.
What?
Yep.
So if you move from... If you go from... I do not know why yet I live to say this thing's to do, sith I have cause and will and strength and means to do it. That's, it has a certain, you can't do that fast. I mean, you can, but it seems to be a clue internally as to
slow down
a little. Take, let this land, let this arrive, let this work in you. Well, we actually, 15 minutes left. I'd love to go to the next one, if everybody's okay with that. And the way this one is broken up, is the first thought is, now I am alone, oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I. So that's the first thought. The next thought goes all the way down to, so actually, see where ha is? It's the one word in the line, ha. You can make a mark there, and then move up five lines to am I a coward. And that's the end of the second thought, in my mind. So a damn defeat was made. End of the second thought. So if you make a mark at am I a coward, does everybody see
before
where that is?
Before am I a coward?
Before am I a coward.
Mm-hmm.
Before am I a coward, that thought goes down to ha.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thought ends with oh vengeance. And then the following thought on the next page ends with about my brain. So I'm going to do this one again, thought to thought, and seeing if it's possible to follow these thoughts. And what's happened here is the players have just arrived, and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, friends of Hamlet's from college, have come back at his uncle's and mother's request to cheer up Hamlet. He's in this Debbie Downer mode and he's impenetrable, as he's explained to us. His old college friends have come and they've picked up these actors on the way. And they think, hopefully this will cheer up Hamlet, a bunch of actors. Hamlet gets an idea. He says, oh my God, this is a ridiculous idea. But he gets this idea that if I have the actors play out a scene before my uncle that is just like what my father told me that my uncle did to him, murdered him. If I play a scene that is the murder of a king in the orchard before my uncle, there's no way he won't have a conniption fit. And his guilt will be made obvious, because how can you not react to that? You'll have some sort of, poor actor playing the uncle has to do this, actually, because Hamlet's plan works. So this is the plan, that I'll get these actors to do this. And actually, sorry, he hasn't come up with this plan yet. He's in the process of the speech. We're going to watch him figure out this plan. But what he's just seen is he's asked the actor to do that speech about Hecuba. I don't remember how it goes, but do it for me. And he does it, and it's a transformative experience. The actor does something that moves Hamlet terribly, and he And he goes about to describe it. What's just happened is this player has presented a speech about Hecuba, the Hecuba from the Trojan Wars. And so I think that's all that we need to know. Because he still is unsure whether his father, whether this is a ghost. Hamlet is, I believe, Lutheran because he went to Wittenberg. You know? No, but you know, he's got this Catholic ghost who's coming and telling him all about purgatory. He doesn't know if he can trust him yet.
Well, he's
so,
Danish, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, so so we'll start with... Now I am alone. Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I. Is it not monstrous that this player here, but in a fiction, in a dream of passion, could force his soul so to his own conceit that from her working all his visage wand, tears in his eyes, distraction in his aspect, a broken voice, and his whole function suiting with forms to his conceit, and all for nothing, for Hecuba. What's Hecuba to him, or he to Hecuba, that he should weep for her? What would he do had he the motive and the cue for passion that I have? He would drown the stage with tears and cleave the general ear with horrid speech, make mad the guilty and appall the free, confound the ignorant and amaze indeed the very faculties of eyes and ears. Yet I, a dull and muddy metal rascal, peek like John of dreams, unpregnant of my cause, and can say nothing, no, not for a king, upon whose property and most dear life a damned defeat was made. Am I a coward? Who calls me villain? Breaks my pate across, plucks off my beard and blows it in my face, tweaks me by the nose, gives me the lie in the throat, as deepest of the lungs. Who does me this, huh? Zounds, I should take it, for it cannot be, but I am pigeon-livered and lack gall to make oppression bitter, or ere this, I should have fatted all the region kites with this slave's awful. What? Bought, villain, remorseless, treacherous, lecherous, kindless, villain, oh, vengeance! Why, what an ass am I? This is most brave, that I, the son of a dear father murdered, prompted to my revenge by heaven and hell, must like a whore unpack my heart with words and fall a cursing like a very drab, a scully, fight upon, oh, about my brain. I've heard that guilty creatures sitting at a play have, by the very cunning of the scene, been struck so to the soul that presently they have proclaimed their malefaction. For murder, though it have no tongue, will speak with most miraculous organ. I'll have these players play something like the murder of my father before mine uncle. I'll observe his looks. I'll tempt him to the quick. If he but blench, I know my course. The spirit that I have seen may be the devil, and the devil hath power to assume a pleasing shape. Yea, and perhaps out of my weakness and my melancholy, as he is very potent with such spirits, abuses me to damn me. I'll have grounds more relative than this. The play's the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king. So, if we were to distill this down into the number of thought breaks I had, if we were to just take Shakespeare's language, what I've done for us is to say on that back page, what a rogue am I? You know, it's a little simpler and shorter. And is it not monstrous that this player here could force his soul to his own conceit, yet I can say nothing? Essentially, I think that that whole thought, in, you know, truncated in Shakespeare's words, and am I a coward? I am pigeon-livered. What an ass am I? Guilty creatures have proclaimed their malefactions. The play's the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king. I mean, essentially, we get the whole story there. And what I'm wondering is whether this could be another way of organically arriving at this language as really essential. So if we can say all this in this many words, do we need anything more than what a rogue am I? Is it important that we say, what a rogue and slave am I? Is there some reason Hamlet has to say, what a rogue and peasant slave am I? And do we need that? Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I? You know, and I think that's a way of slowly reincorporating language that at first seems superfluous. So, is it not monstrous that this player here could force his soul so to his own conceit? Yet I can say nothing. Is it not monstrous that this player here, but in a fiction, could force his soul so to his own conceit, yet I can say nothing? Is it not monstrous that this player here, but in a fiction, in a dream of passion, could force his soul so to his own conceit that from her working all his visage wand, yet I can say nothing? Is it not monstrous that this player here, but in a fiction, in a dream of passion, could force his soul so to his own conceit that from her working all his visage wand, tears in his eyes, distraction in his aspect, a broken voice, and all for nothing, for Hecuba. What's Hecuba to him, or he to Hecuba, that he should weep for her? What would he do had he the motive and the cue for passion that I had? Yet I can say nothing. You know, that we can slowly maybe understand that that's one thought, and that it has many colors that are possible to paraphrase and are possible to distill into, you know, theses. You know, almost every monologue in Shakespeare has a thesis, you know. To be or not to be, that is the question. Let me talk about it for 18 more lines. Let me work it out. Let me figure out what that is. Now is the winter of our discontent. Let me tell you about that. So I think it's always, you know, this was a technique that Mark Rylance, who's a British actor, and he's won 2 Tonys recently, and a wonderful, he was the first artistic director of the New Globe that they rebuilt in London. And I call this the Rylance stutter, because using this technique, you often find yourself kind of like that, you know, that you're saying, you know, as you're building a thought, you'll say something like, yet I, a dull and muddy metal rascal, you know, that there's a kind of a, it's almost a trick of making it seem as though you're composing it in the moment. And his is like a stutter. And yet it's not distracting whatsoever. It does give you a very sense of, you know, him coining this language as he speaks it. Which comes back to this thing we brought up yesterday of apprehension versus comprehension. And something I want to keep returning to is that this, I believe, helps you to apprehend that sense. Because we can all learn to comprehend it, but the actor and hopefully the audience, you know, receiving a play from actors who are doing this are able to follow that thought as it's formed. That it's not known, not every thought we have is already figured out before we finish the sentence. You know, there are actually many thoughts in Shakespeare that are being composed in the moment. And I think these are 2 techniques, and I think we spent more time on the first, and I think it was, I hope, a way that you can, if you ever want to see a play, feel less intimidated before going, even with 2 of the speeches. And then when you get to those speeches, you can say, oh yeah, compost, or, you know, dude man, the dude god guy. But does anybody have any thoughts on that second? I didn't give people as much time to speak on that second idea of the distilling of the thought.
For me, one of the differences, the distilling is, for me, sort of how I live my life. And the Shakespearean text is, for me, what makes it poetry or art. You know, I mean, I'll sometimes think, well, what a jerk I've been. You know, but that's it. I mean, that's not poetry. But then this, when he sort of expounds and circles around it, it has, it's really beautiful.
So it helps you to,
yeah.
the distilling, realizing that there's maybe more to what it's your...
Yeah.
It's
yeah. I think that it not only makes me identify with my own feelings around certain things, it makes me truly care and enter into the angst of the character. Mm-hmm. If he were just to say, boy, am I a rat, yeah, are we all, but I so the distillation, is important, but oh, I don't like this as much.
Yeah, that's great.
I don't want to take anything away from this language, either. I just love the language. And you can viscerally feel this angst, and it is humanity. It is human. Mm-hmm. And I just think he's so brilliant with that.
Yeah, and do you feel that the distilling, that approach to it kind of diminishes it for you?
Sorry,
we didn't really apply.
I guess for me, it does. I like the first two ways we worked with it. I guess because I still love the language. I don't want to distill it.
Why ever break it down into parcels? And sorry, we are anybody who needs to go. I'd love to talk with anybody who wants to stick around, but
I really like that way of looking at it, because it gives, with the way that you put the key signpost, right? These are the places that he has to get semantically for
mm-hmm.
me to get across. And it really kind of reminded me in some ways of an it's a way to think about it as an improvised solo. It's obviously
mm-hmm.
written text, but it feels like a blues solo has to get to this spot, right? In 12 bars you're going to end up there. And so then it becomes this sudden process of understanding how the improvisation works
and finessing
gets you to there. And so taking language, which is so composed,
right,
and thinking about it in those terms as an actor might, as an improvisation that you have to get to this other point, to this other thought.
This is the
reason. I thought that was really an exciting way to think about it.
I like that.
I would just add, it helps, what you've done is help me understand and stay with the Shakespeare text. I'm so used to living in a world. It may just be me and my profession,
mm-hmm.
but I'm so used to every sentence is a new thought and it builds on the next one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think about extended thinking about
luxurious.
One. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when I go to Shakespeare, I'm always thinking, what's the next thought? I never realized that it would be one thought for many lines. It's just because I live in this
right.
thought per line
yeah, you
world.
Take four thousand
words. Oh, sound bite. I mean,
I do. I live.
Yeah,
I'm a professor, so every sentence is a new thought, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, quote, good writing is when I read it and write it.
Mm-hmm.
But so I didn't realize. I was waiting for the next thought when I should be indulging in the one thought for a long time. In other words, you helped me realize, I should be listening to Shakespeare in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what good preaching
does.
It takes very simple thoughts and says them in really wonderful and elaborate ways. So if you read God's Trombones, the collection of poetry by James Weldon Johnson that tries to capture the rhythm of African-American preaching in the 1920s, it's an amazing... It is you were saying blues, but it's a jazz theme, riff, variation that deepens and hammers and builds all at once.
Yeah, that's great. I do think there are.
And let thee not to the end too tardy come, or...
I'm a preacher. I can say that.
Wonderful.
I'm sorry I interrupted. This.
I thought the two ways of taking it apart are really interesting. Because both of them help me understand it in a way that I hadn't before. Differently, but just a very
good,
very interesting way to understand it.
And just to recap, what we started with was slightly a variation on this theme, which was the thought-to-thought versus line versus the verse. observation somewhat slavishly of line endings. And I think what I've found mostly is that these two, are great. All of these sort of four approaches have different ways in which they work in different plays. You know, the earlier plays, he much more consistently thoughts were one line. Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house. You know, that everything ends on the line, actually. And now by the time we get to Hamlet later in his career, they're careening across lines and they're stopping in the middle of lines and you have, you know, mid-stops and it gets more complex. But yeah, I think as a way to keep thinking about it, I hope that, yeah.
I think sometimes I appreciate the craft of the delivery of that the actor gives to me, where sometimes I may not understand what we're talking about is the arc of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
That arc, I might not understand all that I would have if I just paraphrased or gone into it this deeply, but just by sometimes inflection and movement, all of the other pieces that go into the delivery will help convey that meaning, that arc of meaning, in the total. And I appreciate that in a good acting.
There you aren't half bad.
Yeah, you piece out my imperfections with your thoughts. But yeah, good. Cool. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
For keeping me late.
So are you doing more sessions?
Yeah, we're gonna have a. No sessions tomorrow, but Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And then Friday, we're going to have a kind of, I'm going to have a sort of presentation or a performance. I'm planning on getting the kids from Willy Wonka to do a short scene.